Good evening and welcome to the March 2024 edition of Poet Radio. My name is Chris Funkhauser, and on this month's program, I'm hosting my friend and colleague, John Curley. John is a poet who has been teaching literary and cultural studies courses in the humanities and social sciences at NJIT since 2001, and in recent years, his research has, at least in part, engaged with the city of Newark. In fact, we're meeting today in Newark, where we are christening a new podcasting lab on campus. John hails from Massachusetts and now lives in New York. He's author of 5 collections of poetry, and I'm glad to finally have the chance to bring him on the show to read poems and talk poetry. Greetings, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's wonderful to be with you, Chris, in the new arc of Newark and on the program with you finally.
Yeah, excellent. I'm looking forward to the session and hearing your poems. And I don't know how interested you are in talking about other things, but since we're here on campus in Newark, maybe we should begin by talking about the city, your relationship with it, how it has made an impact on your teaching and possibly even your writing.
Absolutely. Well, it goes back way, way back. I was never anything but a late bloomer, but what did become very apparent to me at a very early age is that my public school education in southeastern Massachusetts was just not doing it for me. And so I think it was about 13 years old when I decided to self-medicate by self-educating oneself. And I just stormed the local college library and read indiscriminately through the stacks, probably the worst kind of education one can have, exclusively textbook enterprise. But at the age of 13, poetry meant very little to me, but since it was there as subject, object, and agent, I figured I'd have to school myself in poetry. And I just happened to pick up a book called The Dead Lecturer, and the author, Leroy Jones, was staring at me, and I was staring at him, and I opened the book. And I guess it was a matter of what T.S. Eliot once wrote about how a poem can sometimes communicate before it's understood, because I had no idea what a dead lecturer was, and what I was reading was very powerful, only half understood. But I just remember looking at the back flap and just seeing that he was from Newark, New Jersey, and I remember thinking that is something that I'll always have to keep in mind, and who would have thought that many years later I'd be teaching in Newark and seeing Amiri on the streets of Newark, not as much as your good self, but every, you know, convergence was a wonderful one. And so
I remember coming into, you know, into contact with Baraka's writing, and it was terrifying. Yeah. Honestly, I could understand it maybe too well. It was a play, The Toilet. And wow, it was a drama class, not literature, where I saw it. And that was, profound. And, and then getting to know his work was he's operating on another level, you know, for me as, or us as teenagers or 20, early 20s. And I couldn't believe to actually meet him. And because I come to teach here at NJIT and... Right. You would see him. I met him in line at a concert at NJ Pack, of all places. And, he was very affable and welcoming, honestly. He gave us his card, said, "We're having these salons, and come over anytime." I was like, "You got to be kidding me." You know, part of me, I'm shaking in my boots. And then it was an amazing, magical social environment around him. Sure.
Absolutely. That card of his is in my office upstairs. And I remember when he presented it to me. He said, "John Curley, give me a call whenever you need anything." And that card moldered in my wallet for many, many years. And I'd pull it out and want to call the number. And I could never think of anything concretely enough that was worthy enough to give him a call. And I finally took it out of the wallet and laminated it. And it's now on my...
Laminated. Yeah, wow. Very cool.
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about, I know you teach classes that focus on Newark.
Absolutely. And the literature seminar, Newark Narratives, is one I've taught since Yeah, January of 2014. So the passing of Amiri just occurred a few days before that spring semester. And it was a class, you know, I'm very much for wanting to bring light to the people and the works that mean a lot to me. And so I wanted a good excuse to bring Amiri Baraka into the classroom. But it was also a class born out of frustration because year after year, I talked to students who had been here 4 or 5 years and they had no organic connection with the city of Newark whatsoever. And mind you, I had just recently left Northern Ireland for a year before I came to NGIT. And, you know, the colonial reality of Northern Ireland, specifically Derry, might be different from Newark, but I started thinking about colonial mentalities and is NGIT a kind of garrison? Is it a colony if these students are not leaving the perimeter? So it was actually frustration with getting to know students that did not even have the slightest curiosity to explore the city where they were learning. And so I thought, geez, what kind of, you know, vampirism is this, you know, sucking the intellectual and social and cultural capital of a city and then just like walking away. And so that began the course, and I'm really excited to see students oftentimes very gradually getting engaged in the local Newark scene and developing a great appreciation, especially for Baraka and his work.
You must take them on field trips, or, I mean, do they have to go to the library or down, you know, any, what do they do?
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, I tell students that, you know, both pedagogically and just, you know, curly-wise, there's pattern, there's recognition. So I only learned before my 1 o'clock class today that there is a happening at 6 o'clock tonight, visual artworks down at the Haynes Building, Newark Express, that are inspired by Blues People, his 1964 book on music. Mm-hmm. So my 6 o'clock class doesn't know that we will be making our way down there, but that will hijack the class and have them be on site and off campus. And we also go down to the Philip Roth personal library that just opened up in summer of, I think, 2021, down at the Newark Public Library. And if there are events happening, pre-pandemic, there seemed to be a kind of rhythm of a roster, rather, of events regularly happening and diverting the class. But since the pandemic, a lot less in terms of happenings. But if we can get people into the classroom, or even better, out of the classroom and into Newark, that's the ideal.
Mm. Well, Newark is the birthplace and home of great singers, writers, athletes. I'm wondering, and also home to a world-class art museum that a lot of people don't know about, and I presume you introduce students to that as well?
Absolutely. And, you know, for me, it's key to cultivate, again, under the shadow of Baraka, a notion of community and collaboration. So there are two Newark-based filmmakers, Mary Lou and Jerome Buongiorno, who've become very close friends and also collaborators. That began with a screening of their 2007 documentary, Revolution 67. There was a screening and then a Q&A, and afterwards they had told me that they were commissioned to make a short 3D film for the centenary of the Newark Museum, now Newark Museum of Art, and did I know any poets? And so I drafted some work, and my nasally voice was, you know, on a loop for probably far too long for the people that work at the museum.
All right. Well, I think it's maybe about that. Thanks for all of that. Maybe we will return to talking about things around the city, but your nasally voice, it's one of the reasons you're here, John, hey, is to put it out there on the FM airwaves forever and ever.
Right on.
You are listening to Poet Radio on WGXC, and the guest this month is John Curley. So I'm going to invite John to read some poems at present.
Thank you, Chris. I think I'll begin, as I typically do at most readings, is that at some point during my own reading, I try to adopt a poem, share a poem that seems like a logical selection for that day or evening or whatnot. So I'll start with a poem by Amiri Baraka, An Agony As Now, because it features in the first poem of mine that I'll read today. And it triangulates Baraka with Curly and also Bob Thompson, whose work I first saw at the Newark Museum of Art. So this is An Agony As Now, and it will come up again in my poem. I'm in someone who hates me. I look out from his eyes, smell what foul tunes come into his breath, love his wretched women. Slits in the metal for sun, where my eyes sit turning at the cool air, the glance of light, or hard flesh rubbed against me, a woman, a man, without shadow or voice or meaning. This is the enclosure, flesh, where innocence is a weapon, an abstraction, touch, not mine or yours. If you are the soul I had and abandoned when I was blind and had my enemies carry me as a dead man, if he is beautiful or pitied, it can be pain as now as all his flesh hurts me. It can be that, or pain as when she ran from me into that forest, or pain, the mind, silver spiraled world against the sun, higher than even old men thought God would be, or pain, and the other, the yes, inside his books, his fingers, they are withered, yellow flowers, and were never beautiful. The yes, you will, lost soul, say, beauty, beauty practiced as the tree, the slow river, a white sun in its wet sentences, or the cold men in their gale, ecstasy, flesh, or soul, the yes, their robes blown, their howls empty, they chant at my heels, not at yours, flesh or soul as corrupt, where the answer moves too quickly, where the God is a self, after all. Cold air blown through narrow blind eyes, flesh, white-hot metal, glows as the day with its sun. It is a human love I live inside, a bony skeleton you recognize as words or simple feeling. But it has no feeling, as the metal is hot. It is not given to love. It burns the thing inside it, and that thing screams.
Mm. Wow. What year is that from?
I think that's 65.
Wow.
And so in summer of 2023, I attended two exhibitions of the painter Bob Thompson, who passed away in 1966 and caroused with Jones Baraka and actually painted his portrait. And one of the exhibitions last summer was called Agony and Ecstasy. And so there had to be another agony with Baraka. So An Agony as Now, and now is the poem for Bob Thompson, 1937 to 1966. Painter, premier, quester, art star, after the fact, and facts and art go together weirdly, like your Edenic scenes where strange, vicious birds enter the scenes and disturb them, inter them. Let me come at you multiply in various modes, off kilter and out to sea, because you see, when you left the palette for the paper, you gave some navigation charts as to where you watery were. You wrote in thick riverine ink, I'm awake, I'm awake, I'm a wave licking the shore. My tongue is water bathing my lips. My eyes struggle to see the bathing of my lips. I, my tongue, is me. In your wake, I take the fifth take of intake of that arresting orange canvas of yours as it comes crashing down amid my mind's stretched sense of all that comes down, the pikes and wakes, all that had made your figure fret among those aerial leviathans, those bane birds. What was your leviathan specifically, Bob, bopping as you did among the painted fields and selves and seas? You were there too with George Oppen. Truth is also the pursuit of it. The two shows of yours I attended last month made some advertising overtures for your work, neither of which you would have perhaps written or painted, but let them fold into this poem, portrait, and see where they head. So let us all be citizens and agony and ecstasy. some allowed to be more than others, those citizens who, while the ratio of A to E, agony to ecstasy, is always in favor of the former, an agony, as now, as then, as the poem, an agony, as now, written by Leroy Jones, whose family you painted. That family is us, in ours, maybe. I like your work, truth is also the pursuit of it. This is called, this is a new poem called The Installation of Fear. Some of the parts were invoiced, intoned, all those invoices dwelling as opposed to indwelling, waiting. The machinery confers a kind of hope of slash for obliteration, the embedded conceit, crypto-concrete of the technological urge, age, agape, estranged, all pixelated into hazardry, obsolete in any sense, especially the non. The installation of fear is a mixed media marvel of materials locally and internationally sourced, stretched canvases of bodies, flesh really, really combined and curated by the sister acts of Auschwitz and Hiroshima. Abstract and not, the figures dot the lines like red blood cells or the cells in which blood reddens to a burst of grave, floating in the ether, virtual sphere, virtueless here, air suffocating into the emblem of artful or artless execution, brush and palette and firing squad, Glock and roll, lo and behold, don't count your hatchets or hatchlings before they match. The artists who did this did us, us was those, us brought them here by our corporate sponsors, benefactors, benzene benisons of the famed famished and further gone, ghosted by the headlines obscuring the art. But the exhibition is now on view regardless, inlaid finally, now the final virtual painted stone, free now for fear. The pain has pain in it, fear and ear, but afraid, be afraid. All has been installed and ill-willed for a while, chased the claimants who no longer claim to possess, but only show.
Yowza, John. So did I see somewhere you have a book coming out called The Installation of Fear. Is that right?
That's right. That's the title poem of a collection that will be out in the fall from Marsh Hawk Press.
All right. And so maybe we should talk about that later. But anyway, The Installation of Fear. I mean, you think that's where we're at?
Yeah, I couldn't remember the source, but there was a discussion on the radio sometime in early spring, and it wasn't vis-a-vis the world so much, but someone was talking about a art installation, and I think that there was like a glitch in the transmission, and I think because it was an audio installation, there was talk of installation for your ear, but it sounded with the kind of quick pizzle like fear. So I thought installation of fear. Is there a monument that should be constructed to contain and represent the real for now? So yes, that poem is, I guess, symptomatic of certain kind of structures of thought and structures in the world that seem to be shadowing all too much.
Yeah, I mean, I think of, say, the xenophobia that happened after 9/11 as a real example of this, like, you know, we have to be afraid of, you know, the other. And, you know, I think this is one of the things that the news media thrives on. I mean, that's kind of what I was taking away out of that. I had no idea you were, you know, the installation of fear just seems to be like a type of oppression that we have to contend with all the time, all of us, all the time. And you know, interesting and terrifying reality. I mean, I suppose it helps to be aware of that that's happening, so I don't mind saying it.
Right.
Anyway, great. Keep going, yeah.
All right. I'll read a short bit from, it's one long poem called Remnant Halo. And, you know, I'll read the, to give you context, I'll read the intro. Far from being a confessio, this work is mostly a confusio, an ardent yet failed attempt to come to terms with the haphazard thought and experience that have denied me a stable place in the world. A profusion of confusion has inundated me since March 2020, and I figured I should display and splay it, all the while trying to, at the same time, reclaim some personal territory of coherence and clarity in the process. In early September 2020, I put aside a manuscript in the making and turned to this project. The inspiration was exhaustion, so too that dominating sense of confusion that stoked resentment. Whenever my students asked me how I was feeling or how I was doing, I would inevitably reply, "I don't know. I cannot process any of this. I still am, prosaically and psychologically speaking, that vast clotted cloud of unknowing. However, the practice of poetry helps me translate that unknowing into certain provisional notions, sentiments, reflections, and commentaries." So this collection, Chris, Remnant Halo, basically was born out of the fact that I was absolutely blocked and dealing with the early trauma of the lockdown and making the grave mistake of walking past NYU Langone in early April 2020 after it was reported that over 900 people were dying on site every day and seeing something out of Dante's Inferno. I really, when classes went remotely, students all asked in all four classes, "Can we still meet synchronically?" And I said, "Absolutely." So the classes became, you know, de facto therapy sessions and also classes. But students would ask me, "How are you doing?" I said, I can't really process this. So it really took poetry as a kind of instrument mm-hmm. for me to sort of get into, you know, my own head and my own understanding of what was happening. So I'll just read a short bit because I like to, you know, collaborate, because we just heard Bob Thompson, Anna Mary Baraka, and Curly having an excuse to join their company. I'll read a bit part where we bring in the artist David Wanarovich. So many centuries. What do we need here? We need a perpetual people verse to displace the vermiform verbiages prominent in our everyday squeal and spiel. Dreamers can dream, and in Rojava, that modest dream territory of North and East Syria, fragile yet firm, still the communal correlative to the poem as world mover thrives, in spite of conflicts internal and exo-exacerbated, autonomous, author, auto-cathonous, authors emerging from grounded legacies instead of established academies. The autodidact dedicated to art is no fiction. As Rimbaud's face rode the MTA, thanks to David Wanarovich's project, his provision to make I as other, both himself and not self, Arthur Modite and Arthur made other, both done away, gone away so damn prematurely. I often pass DW's last residence on the corner of East 12th Street and 2nd Avenue, look up at his bedroom window, and wave a greeting 30 years too late. The plague took him. Quote, quoting a Wanarovich poem, "Dying is a mirror expressed in artifices." D was a poet as well as a painter, prophet too, pandemic paraclete, sage of rage. You would stand indignant as virus vectored across the globe, abetted by emissaries of ignorance and mortality reducers, would defy the tide and stand not for the mayhem moving across and through us, in us too. Amens over mayhems, praise be the solar plexus placed prayer, prayer, the soma arada that may yet move mouths into configurations congenial to grace. Grace, the grace race still instructs space. Let us now resurrect the representation, if not the thing itself, of pilgrim's progress in the form of a remnant halo, shared by disintegrating persons and jellyfish, each fortified by the fierce, frantic gesture towards renewal, while uncertain futures await on either shoreline or soul side. So that's from Remnant Halo. And I should have explained, too, that if it wasn't clear for the poem, that Wanorowicz did a series of pictures where he got friends to ride the MTA, shoot heroin, hang out on the West Side, donning a mask of Arthur Rimbaud. So you got Arthur Rimbaud and David Wanorowicz and the plague and everything else I could pack in there.
Yeah, quite a bit, including some marvelous wordplay. You know, so far in the past few minutes, you referenced visual art a good bit, but I also know of your interest in music. In terms of, you know, what fuels your poetry, does that ever come into things as well?
I think I'm oftentimes completely wrong or incomplete about my own work. For example, there's one volume that I did called Angles of Incidents, and it was read by one family member as a book of lament for a family member who, quite frankly, I was not directly thinking about at all. But then when I reread my own work, realized that her passing was imprinted entirely in every single poem. The poem is basically a kind of celebration and cemetery for a person that I did not know that I was writing about. So I think that only semi-recently that I realized that, at least in some of the work that I do, that it's not a direct influence, but the sheer linguistic anarchy of early 80s rap and hip hop really imprinted itself on my lyrical register in ways that didn't really occur to me until way after those initial listenings, but that really imprinted itself.
So that directly influenced your poetry.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Right. All right. Well, maybe we'll go back to that as well. Why don't you keep reading? Great to hear the poems.
Sure. I'll read some whiz bang poems to lighten it up a bit. But before I do, so once again, I can bring Amiri back into memory and into the sound waves. On the acknowledgments page of this 2015 volume called Hybrid Moments, which gets its name from a punk band from Lodi, New Jersey, the Misfits, by which I mean the original 1977 to 1983 incarnation. Hybrid Moments, yeah. If you're going to scream, scream with me. Moments like this never last. But the last part of the acknowledgement page says, I work, write, and fight the night in Newark, New Jersey. Our presiding civic hero and poetic muse is Amiri Baraka, who died last year. As he inscribed in my copy of Translucency several years ago, unity and struggle. Unity and struggle, Amiri. The last shout out I send to you and the powerful people of your city. Let's make the city sing. So here are some whiz-bang poems. Whiz-bang. I'm getting drunk on words, writing these. Actually, I'm getting drunk drinking drinks with digins in them, whiskey too, sending to my liver thoughts through a flu compelling me to beguile you and ask, do you come here often? Sorry, I can't really see. The print in this particular volume is so small that it's hard to read well. Let's see here.
It's all right, you know, those little stutters, I think they added to the delivery of the poem.
I hope so.
No, it's like I thought maybe they were intentional.
Yeah, no, I was just squinting to, for this too small font. Whiz bang! Facebook became to Facebook, and all of a sudden, the likenesses of my familiars and sort of familiars were wiped out. I had difficulty recalling them. None got in touch or wrote on my walls. All was still until I removed the epidermis from my face and photographed it before I went to hospital, looking like marbled meat and bleeding exquisitely. After I posted it, I got hundreds of lovely notes, and all my contacts' online faces were restored. Whiz bang, the poem was encrypted due to a virus. A systemic error was discovered, and it lay not in the poem, but in the minds of citizens. Tested regularly for 14 days in 14 parallel lines. The virus was a synonym for neglect. The people died. The poem lived on. Whiz bang, a gaucho and Marlon Brando, pre-deceased, walk into a transvestite bar outside Milwaukee. They are dressed alike, identical, so no one knows who's who. Candy Darling throws a leather shoe, thinking she's hit her target, and weeps. That her last tango in Paris was the summer prior. Whiz bang, the thrill is gone. The thrill is gone? Is this just an exercise in German romanticism, or worse, semantics? The thrill never goes. It stays as a tremor behind the scenes, and it will get you. Oh yes, it will. Whiz bang. Went into the Black Forest to break brown bread with Heidegger, but he was not there. A marionette with lipstick smeared on its head lay in a corner of the absent philosopher's cottage. It grew dark, and I despaired. Then I fled. Being and non-being became catchphrases for a hoax, trap, bloody murder. And those are the whiz-bangs.
So I just asked you a question about music and influence, and you answered... And I knew that that was only a partial answer. I knew it. Mm. And then, lo and behold, you're connecting the Misfits and Amiri Baraka and the Whiz Bang, right?
That's right. That's absolutely.
That's not a common engagement.
Right.
With
right.
the, I mean, but yet makes perfect sense if you know the Misfits and you know Baraka. Of course, you know. I think maybe Amiri was a bit... As time passed as of 80s or something, he became in a way more organized or something. But that unity and struggle concept, I mean, that was his thing. He had a newspaper he published called Unity and Struggle. I think he signed hundreds or thousands of books, Unity and Struggle. It was a thing he really promoted. Whereas, of course, we all know of Baraka's divisiveness in his past, but he evolved certainly as a poet and as a person. I mean, I'm still surprised that people are holding him to the standard of what he said in the 50s and 60s when he lived 50 more years. You know, so it's odd that you know, and I think, you know, people who want to be critical have something to criticize. However, you also have to acknowledge the growth and the wisdom that came out of Baraka. Was a punk. He actually was a punk. And before there was punks, he was definitely onto that. But he, you know, he was always wanted to, you know, raise people's hackles. He didn't have any problem with that. But at the same time, it was coming from an informed and aware consciousness. So, and that's, you know, I think where he does cross with the Misfits. You know?
Absolutely. And let's see. So, well, I cited David Wanarovich, whose studio with Peter Hujar has long since become a movie theater on the corner of 2nd Avenue and 12th Street. On 11th Street lives the great... writer Gary Indiana, who once wrote that one never gets more intelligent by reading readers' comments on any kind of source, online or otherwise. And it was, really disgusting in January of 2014, reading as comments to so many different obituaries of Amiri's, quotations of poems from the 1960s, without context and making it seem as if it had just been recently written. I have the argument that a lot of that work from the 1960s, the more harrowing, hate-filled, problematic work, should see the light of day, should be republished simply because it makes that much more epic the ethical and artistic trajectory that he really went on. And yeah, I tell students when we're looking at some of the work from the poem Black Art to others that, you know, some of it is problematic, some of it is toxic, but it can also at the same time be very powerful, and within the context of the poem and outside of it too, is understandable. Not necessarily justifiable, but definitely understandable. And I know you saw him in many readings, and I did as well, and I always thought that his apologies were almost to a fault, because he would he would own it for a work that he wasn't actually presenting at that reading. He talked about how, you know, I was on this awful anti-Semitic kick, and you know, I was really, you know, far off base in that, but almost a kind of Maoist self-criticism often. He would take himself to task with the previous homophobia, the sexism, the anti-Semitism, and whatnot. But yeah, he was a punk, and I know the author, David Foster Wallace, once said that, you know, what should a writer do, or an artist do, and that, you know, disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. And I always found it edifying that even Baraka's own fan base, going to a reading and him saying something that was particularly virulent against, say, President George W. Bush, you would hear in the room, this, like, level of discomfort that made me very comfortable, because I thought, geez, you still have the power to go and walk that singular path and be able to ultimately bring us all with you, or most of us with you, but you are not conforming devolving into complacencies and just the kind of herd mentality and sentiments that you are still making people think. You're still very dangerous, and you're also absolutely incredibly hilarious.
Yeah, true. And like being around him, as I've said before, is like being around a walking, talking history lesson. And so the hate-filled stuff, well, you know, if you had your head bashed in the Newark riots, you might have a certain, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not really trying to defend what, you know, some of the things that he said. And, you know, he never softened, even though he grew. And he did not apologize for things later on, like the somebody blew up America. I will not apologize. I will not resign, because he was not making the stuff up that was in that poem, that was out in public. And, you know, it wasn't like he was the one who, you know, thought of the concepts that people found so problematic in that and villainized him, you know, so... Yeah, interesting.
And what I also found so wonderful is his radical empathy, his real deep, avid interest in what would seem to be... I remember having a conversation with him, and he was talking about a garment worker's... struggle in Dhaka, Bangladesh, that I think involved about 13 women in a factory. And he was talking about that as if, you know, there was a situation raging right down the street. So he had that kind of empathy that he did not have to geopolitically be in the neighborhood to take great, I know you know this, but for our listeners, the fact that, you know, that notion of like, you know, anywhere where there's oppression, that's where I am. That was his kind of like thinking. And it was never a pretense, and it was never evolved into a style. It was always just kind of like very natural and organic sympathy that I just find really inspiring.
What a blessing to have been around him. Yeah. Well, John, if you don't mind continuing to read, this is very provocative.
Absolutely. All right, this is called Prime Time. Now dream time, doom time, the doom idiom as it shoals, arrests, all other movements but itself. Were we not worthy for promise, even in spite of so much evidence against us? Against it? Against us? This is never a process I can understand, given that degradation and objection always lean to abstraction, pitch too eagerly to abstraction. Revere reverie seems now the preferred art, nudging us to adopt, while we abhor all those qualities we should dispel, as well as the concept of totalities. These lines are coming, commanding, resisting in real time, as the evening beckons night, night thoughts, not thoughts, and the poem performs its own arrest. And I hear police sirens as the poem is being arrested.
Yeah. I don't know, these microphones might not have picked them up, but I could hear them also.
Excellent. I'll do a series of very brief poems. Laments nourished in the sprawling space, those echo charts trembling in the aftermath of so many death masks worn in the habit of scars, SARS, scares, no stars, just steles. Emiscerated immigrants, submersible titans, oceanic eyries, mass mythology of mayhem, and in spite, still reveries, oxidizing conceits, swim past hopeless bruised buoys, destiny's plumb depths, reverse engineering drowning, hopes with utopia, maybes of tomorrow tides. Rigor mortis de rigueur, default, spiritual mode made dominant in the mental breakdown invoked by code of processed processionals of congregants bent to find astonishment at the unfastening of it all. Even despite agonies, engulfing calamities, and the seeming passion for ruination and ruins, there engenders angels of angles, secular and secure, in the science of resistance and the seduction of dissent. Acquiescence to evil in the empirical sense, a convention bias in almost every occasion where the term moves from the theological to the textbook logical in the complicit bindings of the book you now have in your hands. Wish fulfillment and or dream fantasy. Those coniferous trees grow carnivorous leaves that leech the life of lackluster hunters armed with Uzi guards in their secret jacuzzis and plan the seed of destruction for any non-naturalist destroyers who in turn become voyeurs of their own imminent erasures. A phoenix cannot rise more than a few times in a millennium. So far, the temperature to rise so high in Phoenix these past weeks show that Promethean fire was a kind of fracking before the score. Weather as objection, inner and outer, what we are and what we are to be abhorred. The weather vane charts a bleak ontology of meteorology. Sculpt a skepticism and behold how it embeds the weight of futility in its wake. Be vigilant for varieties of non-indignant artifacts, either indigenously blessed or potentially produced. Art making is not the cure, but a procedure to yield faith-giving forms. Two more of these short ones. Blasted heaths and institutions. Perverse those universities given over to death-dealing instructions. Healing is not only a process or state, but a destination amid the lifeless landscapes, a thicketing, thickening plot of relentless creation, a force field of content set to bloom rather than shatter, to shelter, make, or bend better. Law of the excluded middle. If the barren binary is left to wither, translate the trans into a stance with better semblance. For they who are many are mostly you and I and we and they. Go refigure.
Yeah, go refigure. Please. So are those from Installation of Fear?
Yes, yeah. From a sequence called X Spectres.
X Spectres. R-E.
E-X, and then space, and then S-P-E-C-T-E-R-S.
I can imagine that it's happened before, but hearing the Uzi Jacuzzi rhyme is certainly makes one think. And I noticed you had a few rhymes in there, or at least a couple. Ontology, meteorology. I mean, these things, you know, again, they're like discrepancies that, I don't know, they both stabilize and destabilize, you know, hearing it. Like,
And that has a connection to onomastics, too, because I am my father's aborted doctoral dissertation study in the late 60s. He went to Harvard University to take on Jonathan Swift and found that the vision of humanity was too dark, and he thought that, this is too much for me. So I'm going to retire this subject matter, and if I ever have children, my firstborn will be Jonathan. And so, yeah, the kind of Swiftian logic, anti-logic of the poems are basically trying to build them up and also demolish them at the same time, to both produce a meaning and also to explode the very concept of there being a, you know, anything but a provisional meaning to be had.
Bravo. Well, that'll keep people interested. I mean, those who are willing to be interested.
Right. I hope so.
Good. Very good. So let me ask, I mean, maybe this is too generic of a question, but we've talked about Newark, and I presume there are lots of things that stimulate you in the world, your kids, your family, and so on and so forth. But is there anything particularly exciting going on in your mind now, inspiring things?
Well, that's a question that I think is abiding with me all the time. I never come up with a ready-made conception of what, you know, the poem is going to be. It's that old line taken by the Shaker community that every force evolves a form. I tend to go into a mode when composing. Basically, I go from a kind of a trance into a dance into a wince. So the concept begins to inform itself in some sort of preconscious level. It gets into the poem. I'm able to compose without too much self-consciousness, and then soon after, not usually right after, but soon after, there's the wince of like, no, this is not, have to begin again. My mantra is, my personal mantra would be from Samuel Beckett and from his little, can't even call it a novella, his novel spec called Worstwood Ho. Try again, fail better. And so my reaction to what is produced usually lends to some sort of like counter aim. So if I was thinking of the work that I was just reading, including The Installation of Fear, as being part of a dialectic, if that's the thesis, then the antithesis, which is going to proceed, you know, beginning now, writing poems in 2024, I'm going to try to be less topical and more personal, but not necessarily personally expressive, maybe personally concussive and dissecting and whatnot. So what inspires me is to sort of break not so much the constraint, but the sort of like pattern that I see emerging in any kind of work, and then just try to swerve, pivot into something quite different.
Great answer. Really, thank you for that. And I think, I certainly think that a good dose of self-criticism is useful for a writer, no doubt about that. It's interesting to me. You sound like you have objectivity in a way that I think most writers don't have over their own work, probably because it's hard for them or anybody to be self-critical, right? So if you can enable that in yourself, then maybe that's a step towards having this kind of objectivity. The wince the wince stage yeah. Of the process. So that's a few interesting.
Yeah, I suppose it's counterintuitive, but I think that just from my own work, like every single effort is a failure, but striving towards the success of the work, striving towards the light, metaphorically speaking, is what I can muster, and it's all I can muster. And I think you're right. If there is a certain kind of complacency that creeps in to whatever mode of light, I'm not just talking about poems, but how one walks in the world, then I think that a little of the self is deteriorating, and the rapidity of that could be informed by how satisfied and secured one feels in the world. So I guess that leads, if we want to go back to the music, I would say one of my favorite tracks by the band Replacements is Unsatisfied. Look me in the eyes and tell me that I'm satisfied, unsatisfied. So I try as hard as I can to be satisfied. Pace, Paul Westerberg, but that's my stance. And it's not a one of willful negation, and I am the antithesis of being a pessimist. But yeah, there's something about a poem necessarily being a kind of failed faculty. It's just a measure of, you know, how much of it works and has the potential to work in the very next poem, which is usually the impetus for the next poem. Can I do this better? Can I do this otherwise? So.
Mm-hmm. I want to flip the meaning on the word faculty, the way you just used it, because we're getting towards the end of our session. And I was thinking about, we started by talking about dead lecturer, hearing you talk about your work in Newark Narratives and JIT. I just wanted to say something especially corny, and that it's great that you're here as a live lecturer.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much.
What? You're the live lecturer.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, you learn from the dead lecturer.
That's right. I was dead, but then I was resuscitated.
Yeah, that's very cool. But I would like, if you have maybe five or so more minutes, we might as well send things out. I'd like to remind everyone they're tuned to Poet Radio, WGXC. And I'm Chris. You know, John Curley's been my guest this afternoon, this evening, whatever time it is, wherever you are. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in to our community radio station based out of Acre, Catskill, and Hudson, New York. We appreciate your engagement and attention. And I want to remind those of you who would like to support the station but yet haven't yet been able to do so, it's never too late to become a sustaining supporter. All these great programs on WGXC, great variety, excellent and knowledgeable programmers. Head on over to WGXC.org and find the donate button. Once again, John Curley reading his poetry in Newark, New Jersey. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned to WGXC Radio for open ears.
Great. Thanks again, Chris, for this wonderful, radiant session. I'll bring it back to the classroom. At one point, students asked me, I think I shared a colorful anecdote, and someone said, what are your dreams like? And I said, well, if your dream life is in inverse proportion to the excitement of your waking life, I live a very exciting life because I seldom remember my dreams. And when I do, they are typically really banal. The Technicolor is not all working. It's usually under a grim gray sky, and I'm walking around in a place I don't recognize and see people that I don't really know. Well, that very night, whenever that occurred, I had a dream in which the late, great Chilean novelist Roberto Bolaño basically came to me in the dream and gave a kind of wink, wink, like, I know this can't be true. I've been dead since 2003, but yes, I am in your dream, and this is actually happening, and you can try to deny it, John Curley, but it's happening. So this is called a poem for Roberto Bolaño, 1953 to 2003. In the dream, fragments of images gather and condense, contract. Your figure emerges, then suddenly stops. A red shirt, jacket the color of jade, glasses that frame eyes as radiant suns. You greet me with smiles, no introduction. We know each other. How can this be, R? I've read your books, and you've been dead 6 years. Maybe you saw me as my eyes gaze down on your words, pages like paned glass, through which the author watches his reader as he constructs faith line by line by line. As the dream went on, you decided to live up the street from me in a house painted in red and jade tones like your quirky clothes. Roberto, you're close, like a good neighbor. Each day I'll visit. Do you read me? Good. We'll be fine friends. Come by whenever. You already do, ghost, author, companion. Help me build a porch for my citadel, a new addition to my home you built long before we met. And this is a poem based on a letter I got from the poet Fanny Howe. This is called For Fanny Howe, April 20th, 2007. You clench your sieves and sift them out. The body hangs like threads, pours down its raiments rain-like. The weather inside is never the weather outside. That death's head is just a symbol, a distraction. Spirit still follows. In the textured plots we planted, no graves, but cuticles grew. A house appeared. Could we live in it? We cried because we grew, and we grew scared. But the parachutes overhead, graffitied with hope, told us something of our happiness was true, some part at least, and kept it afloat. Was the leavening of ourselves our souls? Skins like tapers fly across the space, disappear. The body, once placed here, traces itself in the air.